We're going to be talking tonight about relational practice and the path of awakening together. How's that? But I'd like to begin with a little relational practice. And taking this from the Dalai Lama, who offers this meditation at the beginning of many scientific meetings to warm up the room, he says. So I would like to invite you to stand, and this time with mindfulness, just watching the body standing. Body standing. Breathing. The Buddha taught mindfulness, sitting, standing, walking, lying down. Just allowing the eyes to open and just looking around the room at who is here, these precious human beings sharing this moment. And allowing your eyes to meet another and perhaps linger a little longer than used to in social situations, and if a smile arises, to let it be and notice how that registers in the body. Thank you. Now we can sit. If you were a neuroscientist, you would say that we just had perhaps a mounting anxiety and then a sense of vagal nerve inhibition or neuropeptides, maybe some oxytocin being released, maybe the sense of smiling and the other person's smile activated mirror neurons and all kinds of body connections, heart rate, respiration rate, CO2, metabolism, all those things we touch when we engage with each other. If you were Barbara Fredrickson, you might say that was a micro moment of love, positive emotion that's tuning your nervous system over and over all day long for optimal function. We need that kind of connectedness. If you're Tara Brach, you might say it was a moment of awakening from the trance of separation. Or maybe if you're Thich Nhat Hanh, you would say you touched your true Buddha nature, and that the trance or the sense of isolation or separation that we live in, that we are taught in this culture especially to live in, can fall away and we can experience something like non-separation. And we live in that, perhaps in the separation, and so it feels like we're achieving something, but from a Buddhist perspective we may be realizing the truth of our interconnectedness and knowing it. So that is what I mean by a relational practice. It's a practice where we can engage in coming into and experiencing all of what we feel and the suffering around relationship, engaging, experimenting with perhaps deepening what we stay away from often, a more depth and profound interconnectedness. We may have the opportunity to bring mindfulness to the moments of meeting in relationship, of touching each other at the heart, of influencing, mutual influencing, of mutuality, of the flow of energy that is released when we connect. I think my life, I'll just say one or two things about my own history. I think the truth of my life, the noble truth of suffering in relationships, is that I experienced much suffering in relationships and still do. And I also experienced some of the most profound healing and liberation and profound states of love, connectedness, concentration, equanimity. Many of the states we try to cultivate in mindfulness, in meditation, I have touched in relationship. And a relational practice allows us to bring mindfulness to that relationality, and perhaps in the practice that I teach, which is a co-meditation practice called Insight Dialogue. How many of you have ever familiar with it? It's a co-meditation practice that's been taught in the Vipassana Theravadin tradition with guidelines that support the exploration of opening deeply into relationship and cultivating mental states together towards awakening. So this is a very radical co-meditative practice. It's quite beautiful. But for years as a psychotherapist, I can remember sitting in my house before going to work, before it was fashionable to meditate 30 years ago, and walking into my office as a therapist and sitting for 50-minute concentration sessions with clients and beginning to feel that there really was something similar about sitting alone and sitting together. And really felt some of the most profound relational states in my work with clients. I also experienced this field. I began to think about the field of relationality, the between space, not just the internal, but the between space as a meditative state, space for mindfulness to arise. That we share that space, and that there can be insight that arises between us, what we would call relational insight, discovered together. And Thich Nhat Hanh has actually said that relationship insight cultivated and sustained in relationship and community is perhaps more enduring and penetrating than internally, individually. So this whole area of mindfulness, concentration, the development of insight and wisdom and compassion that can arise relationally has been something I've been thinking about for decades. And a number of years ago, I was thinking about writing about this and was talking with my co-partner, co-conspirator, co-author, co-life partner, co-parent, Steve, whose pen name is Sam, who's a novelist. And there was a convergence of this whole understanding of the relational path with the story of the Buddha's wife. And for many, many years, how many of you are familiar with that story of the Buddha leaving on the night of his only son's birth to leave behind the relationships, to face the wilderness alone internally, and to stay till the end of suffering, and then to offer that path for all humanity as a real beacon of what is possible. Just an extraordinary gift to the world. But for years I would wonder, what about the ones left behind? And I would stop myself from thinking about it. And, you know, but every time I'd read about the great renunciation, it would disturb me a little bit. About 10 years ago, I really started thinking about it. And we started talking about the story and decided this would make quite an interesting story. And being trying to figure out how to write a book, we decided to start with the fictional narrative, which was a creative we call spiritual parable of the path of awakening of those left behind, of those who stay, of those who come more deeply into relationship and walk a path together. So The Buddha's Wife is in two parts, the book. First part is a fictional narrative, which we'll have an opportunity to read you a little bit of. The second part is really a study of that book, which it's the study of that path of relational awakening, how it's arising in our modern world, how perhaps, I think in writing about it as an old story, in which we relied on the very few mentions of the women and those left behind that are in the early suttas, the Pali canon. We stayed with the Theravadin tradition and the way the women were talked about. And from the few mentions, we wove a story together. The second part of the book is how this path of the relational path, the path of relationship and community is arising in our world with many stories of people in this world, in today's world, in our world, and reflections on moments on the path and different aspects of the relational path with meditation practices. So the second part is the nonfiction, first part is kind of fiction. And just to mention very briefly the five things that were known, that were written about. Now, just to say, the Buddha's story, we know there probably was a historical Buddha. Very, very little is actually known.
I can use this one. How about that? Sorry, that was sort of like a Zen wake-up.
Yeah, of what was written about the women left behind. And just to see, the story of Yashodhara, the Buddha's wife, waking up and finding the Buddha gone, and her grief, years of grief, is really written a lot about in the Sri Lankan tradition, the grieving wife. There's the story of her trying to stay in touch with him by hearing about the practices he was doing and her trying to keep those in her palace life. There was the story of the Buddha returning 7 years later, no longer Siddhartha, but as a fully awakened Buddha, and that he told his father, the king, that he would go to see Yashodhara. She refused to come see him when he returned home. And he told the monks that were traveling with him that if she cried, just let her cry. Her grief was immense. If she touched him, let her do that. Even though monks were not allowed to be touched by women, he said, this is okay. And it was said that she brought the son to him and said to the son, seek your inheritance from me. This is your father, speak. Seek your inheritance. And that turned out to be the spiritual inheritance. And his son became a monk, the youngest monk in the Buddha Sangha. And he took him away with him. But the final piece that really inspired me was the story of the women wanting to become. A number of years after the Buddha was there, the women asked if they could join the Sangha of the Buddha. Two times through Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, they were told no. And so the women decided among themselves that they were going to simply go as an act of resistance. They shaved their heads, each to each, went barefoot, took on the robes, walked barefoot for 100 miles. Streets were lined with people watching them. And when they got there, Ananda asked the Buddha again if the women could join. And the Buddha was about to say no, and Ananda said, well, they're here. And it's kind of, it was said that Buddha agreed with very special rules for the women. But to me, the inspiration was how did Yashodhara and the mother, the Buddha's adopted mother, his aunt Pajapati, how did they go from being in grief, abandoned, to a vital community of women that were able to resist the no and go together, to go homeless together. So the icon of the Buddha is shaving his hair and going homeless alone into the wilderness, sitting under the Bodhi tree alone, awakening, and then returning as the awakened one to teach all of humanity. In the story of the Buddha's wife, as we said, the icon, and this is the real shift I would love to offer you all, is the shift in this icon, or the possibility that there's another icon as well as the alone one. When the Buddha does come home, they get to meet each other after 7 years. We got to write the story of what might have been that coming together. But one of the things, and we'll read that, one of the things that Yashodhara says in that meeting, which is the epigram of the book, is, "Dear one, what might have been the benefit? What teachings and practices offered had two or more sat together under the Bodhi tree?" So that is, in telling this story and in offering this new dimension of the path, this is not an oppositional story. This is a dimension that's been hidden in the way the teachings and practices have come down to us through probably male monastic traditions. This aspect of the path probably has not been as developed or practiced or somewhat hidden, neglected, diminished perhaps. And we are offering this as a new dimension that's arising in our time, that could be developed, and that perhaps more than anything is needed in our world to face the collective suffering. And from us, we'll walk you through some of this, but from a circle around the wife, Yashodhara, the women created a circle of compassion, which then became a meditative practice for them and became a circle of service which they took to the world and eventually became a community of awakening. And for those of you who know Thich Nhat Hanh's famous, wonderful prophecy, the next Buddha may be the Sangha. And I think the questions then are, what practices, what conditions would support an awakening community? And that's what I'm hoping that we can begin to investigate together.
I just would fill in that Jana came to me 10 years ago with this story, and being a doctor and a novelist, I thought, oh my God, this is an incredible story. Absolutely. We had had a practice. We've shared a practice for 30 years, but I didn't know the story. And the remarkable thing as a man, I think, is that the Buddha stepped out of relationship to go on his heroic journey to do as Janet said, and that, you know, it's an absolutely astonishing event in the history of the world. The women, Yashodhara, desperate with grief, her suffering attracted the compassion of the other women in the palace. Suffering that compassion, and she stepped into relationship, not just to heal, but the healing became, well, it's what women always do, kind of, but it's not labeled a path, but the healing became a path. And in some sense, the healing became a path, and into it, okay.
This way, Steve. This way.
This way, okay. The healing became a path. And one of the ways to perhaps think of it is it's just another path that has come to light in many different ways in our times, which is the second part of the book, like Alcoholics Anonymous and stuff like that. You can't do it alone. But it's sort of as if these are co-arising paths, the Buddha's path and the wife's path.
You don't need that. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the questions is to, as it's a very frequent question in any tradition, which is whose voice is represented, whose voice is not represented in the stories. What if that voice were to speak and be heard? What more would be taught about the whole reality? This is true with marginalized groups. What is not being spoken, and is the benefit to all of hearing that? And so we offer this to begin to see what perhaps has not been as developed and what is valuable by charting this relational path. So we thought we would read a little bit, but just before we do that, I would just like to invite you to take a moment and allow a relationship in your life, past, present, future, alive or past, to just come to your mind, a relationship that is in some challenge, something stuck, or some way you don't know how to move forward or how to benefit. How to be of benefit. Just a disconnect that's puzzling, painful. Perhaps you've given up on it. But just allow it. See what comes right now. I'd just like to offer the dedication to all these relations, to all our relations of the practice, our time together tonight. And we'll check in at the end and see. No work to do, just hold it in your heart. In the book begins with the death of Pajapati, the Buddha's mother, who has, if some of you know, was one of the great teachers of the first nuns, brought many people, women, into the Sangha, was quite a powerful spiritual person. She is dying, and on her deathbed, she's saying to the Buddha's wife, Yashodhara, that she feels there's something holding Yashodhara back. And the two of them kind of support Yashodhara, their sense that something's being lost as they enter and as they live in the Buddha Sangha, that their path, their Dharma doorway is being lost or subdued, or it's getting hidden in some way. And Pajapati tells Yashodhara, asks her to tell the story. And so it's written around the circle of the nuns hearing Yashodhara tell her story. And we chose the story. Stories are not always seen as in the Buddhist tradition, but stories, rather than getting lost and getting carried away in story, a story can be a way of connecting, a way of actually going beyond the self to something more impersonal, more transpersonal, more not alone, but something that connects us. Our stories connect us if used wisely, and not to separate us. So she's around the bedside telling her story to the nuns, and we invite the reader to join the circle, to be part of the listening, and we invite you in that way as well. So I'll begin. Yashodhara awakened before dawn to the cries of their newborn baby. Siddhartha was gone. All at once, she grasped it. He is gone. The blood seemed to drain from her. She looked down at the baby boy who gazed innocently into her eyes. The shock made her feel that everything she knew had broken apart, fallen out from under her feet, been taken away, become thin as air, unreal. A doorway to all she loved had been slammed shut. She couldn't breathe. When she cried out, everyone heard it. Someone went to find Queen Pajapati. When Pajapati appeared, she saw a wild terror in Yasodhara's eyes as they desperately raced here and there to every face, searching the faces in the chamber itself for some answer. Without a word, Pajapati walked slowly towards Yasodhara. The queen stood before her and opened her arms to hold her. As Pajapati came towards her, Yasodhara felt as if a great kindness was approaching. Yes, even as if a goddess had appeared. Pajapati, standing so tall and alert and calm, Yasodhara was drawn to her eyes so wide, reflecting her own shock. She realized in Pajapati's eyes was something more, something pure and powerful, compassion. Their eyes met and held. Yasodhara rose. Pajapati took her in her arms and asked her to tell what happened. Later, Yasodhara would come to understand that the depth of her grief and the presence of the newborn baby had called up in Pajapati memories of her own experience 30 years before when Maya, her beloved sister, died after giving birth to Siddhartha. She had taken the infant into her arms and raised him as her son. She recalled feeling devastated by the grief of death and the call to life to care for the child. Finding Yasodhara in such distress brought it back vividly, and she was overwhelmed what this would mean. But holding Yasodhara in her arms, feeling her whole body shuddering uncontrollably against the embrace, all at once she realized that she was more experienced in grief than Yasodhara, who had not suffered in love before, had never lost anything she held so close to her heart. Pajapati knew she had to rise again, to mother and strengthen Yasodhara. In that moment, she surprised herself with the strength and clarity that arose in her tight embrace of this dear child's suffering. And then what this would mean to Yasodhara's newborn baby, echoing down and up through all generations. All of this spread out before her as a story being told from mother to mother, child to child, from time past to time future. She had a moment of clarity strong as stone. Come, dearest, look at me. When my sobs stopped, I raised my head from Pajapati's breast and sat up, looked into her eyes. Her gaze was penetrating and steady, holding me there as her arms had. And then with care she spoke to me these powerful words. He has left to find his way through suffering. You must do that here now. We are with you. I know that in this moment it is impossible to believe, but you must listen. I found a way. We will find a way. You will find your way. Your child needs you as Siddhartha needed me. A new door has opened for you, and you will walk through it with us. This is the path of the ones who stay, who endure, who come forth with each other in love. Like Siddhartha, this is your first taste of what everyone must feel of suffering. That's when Pajapati turned and said, tell the other women she must never be alone. Now, back to the scene of the deathbed. Now looking back, Yasodhara went on, I realized I could not leave and try to follow him. I could never leave our child. The most painful part, most terrifying, was that he had closed the door on our deeply shared inquiry into the spiritual meaning of our lives, of our shared life. Now I was alone. In the sanctuary's candlelight, her face showed the depth of that loneliness, the abyss into which she had plunged so many years before. She breathed in and out, came back from that death. She went on, the chasm between this savage grief, this plunge into darkness, and the effort of staying present for my child, the joy of holding this new life. These are the conditions of ordinary human life and suffering. There is suffering in all lives, but there comes at least one moment in every life when extreme suffering knocks on the door, a right moment. And so, dear ones, we much ask, what are the ripe conditions? Her eyes were steady, holding each of us sitting around her and Pajapati and moving on so that we all felt the touch of them like a lingering caress. Under ripe conditions, this ordinary path has extraordinary power to sustain our lives and can lead us towards enlightenment. So in that first story of her waking up and her crying out, we have the basic relational couple. Suffering meets compassion in relationship, and wisdom and arises. This is the external of the internal, of suffering meeting compassion internally. It's really the other side. As the Buddha taught, we practice mindfulness internally, externally, in both. And I think this is a side that of the path that has, as I said, been less developed. But this path, this relational path requires she who cries out and she who shows up. And for those of you who know the story of Kuan Yin, this is the Kuan Yin who comes to all who cry out in suffering. She shows up relationally for that person. And so that asking for help and showing up are part of this very, very first fundamental. Suffering meets compassion in relationship. Do you want to read the circle? And I'll do the devotion. Put the mic like this.
Yeah, right. Okay. Together with Pajapati, the women who had been keeping watch over Yashodhara and her baby soon understood that it was too consuming for each of them to care for her alone. She was angry and bitter, withdrawn and lethargic. There was no respite from her bitterness and guilt. To be alone with her was too painful for any one of them for any length of time. And so Pajapati arranged for Yashodhara and the other women of the palace to gather together at dawn in a grove of pines shaded by the deep green of the ancient trees. Beside a pool there, a small Hindu temple had served as a sacred site for millennia, a doorway for their prayers to the panoply of gods. It had become known as a temple of the goddesses of fertility, where Yashodhara and Siddhartha had made many offerings and prayers before she became pregnant. One morning, the women of the palace and their servants waited in the cool, misty air. They listened as the birds began their day. Pajapati entered with Yashodhara, supported her by the arm. Yashodhara, head downcast, sat down in the grove. Her body seemed to have caved in. Her face was flat and her eyes puffy, mere slits. The others sat in a close circle around her. One woman lit incense. Pajapati began to chant the Hindu prayers. It was as if the energy that existed on the ground in that grove, beneath those ancient trees and beside that pool and temple, was being called forth to meet the desperate Yashodhara and the circle around her. The dawn prayers and shared chants, the moments of silence, seemed to gather the old deep energies of the earth and nature to focus it amongst the circle of women. Yashodhara's tears seemed unending. She wept in silence. The gathering that morning didn't last long. There was work to do, but it had a calming effect. The women decided to meet again at dusk, and this simple ritual practice seemed to take hold and then take shape. The morning prayers were chanted to ask for help for the day from the goddesses and gods. The evening gathering was to give thanks to all the gods for their daily and goddesses for their daily care. Asking for help, giving thanks, every morning, every evening. They called it, this gathering at the grove, their circle of compassion.
In the following days in the circle, each of the women began to share her own life stories and daily learnings. Periods of speaking and listening in silence became the rhythm of the circle, became part of the ritual. Wisdom and compassion grew. Pajapati told me how she came to understand that something had been created of great value beyond what she had imagined. She saw the circle as a vessel containing earth and water, a well of compassion, able to create and nurture new energy, new life, new understanding and wisdom. The heart of each person opening, becoming a channel of that compassion, and the whole circle infused with it, available to all. So together, facing the ocean of suffering. And then the story of the circle holding all of them in their lives begins to emerge for them as they live their relational lives, and they become, call this the path of accompaniment. And all of us, I think, live our lives with this sometimes clear, sometimes conscious, sometimes mindful commitment to particular others in our lives, to walk together, to be together, to grow together, to practice together. So this devotion to particular relationships, to particular beings, is the kind of stuff of their lives. And the practice, which they call the path of accompaniment from birth to death, is this path of being with that they're trying to practice. Yashodhara began to understand that her devotional practice to her son and the others in her circle could expand to encompassing the arising of life to the vanishing of life, the letting in and the letting go, the being with birth and being with death, the first in-breath to the last out-breath, the universal circle of life. In sitting with and being with her mother, who was dying, she committed herself to being mindful, present, and earnestly awake through each moment of the dying. She felt herself stretching, expanding to hold this great arc of life, privileged to be held in her circle, glad to be called forth and able to be with both her mother and her son ardently. In the position of caring for both my child and my mother, she said, I made a vow to be a beneficial presence for these particular others on this shared life journey. And I understood how this vow resonated with the lives of the others in our circle, this journey that is the core and span of each and every life. The unique yet ordinary stories of the women accompanying parents, children, partners, and friends through life had a universal resonance, the life journey of accompaniment. Walking with as a practice from birth to death became our spiritual path, the ordinary devotional path held in this larger circle. Under these ripe conditions, the particular can open to the universal. In the ordinary blossoms the extraordinary. As a rush of rain swept down on the sanctuary's bamboo roof, Yashodhara took several easy breaths. I understood that what we were touching every day in that circle was the practice of accompanying, staying with, being with, and walking with, as with shared intention. Even when this is difficult, this practice cultivates the soil and creates the ripe conditions for awakening. So I just like to share a little bit about this devotional path. I in thinking about how the vows we make, some are partnership vows. I think there's a vow often that parents make to children to be there for life. It's an incredible vow to stay in walking with, in that relation, meeting the other with what's needed at any time. Sometimes to the best of our ability, sometimes it even requires separation for a while. But there's this devotional commitment, which I don't think has been deeply honored and understood as path. And I think this devotional path, Thich Nhat Hanh has written beautifully about in his book on love. And he shared these mantras about in a number of different books. I feel like they're beautiful mantras for the devotional path, and I'm going to just share them and talk a little bit. So a mantra is something that concentrates the mind creates intentionality, creates the capacity to stay with what's most important and to let other things fall away. So the mantras, as he writes, the first one is, Dear One. He starts each with a beloved address, with a loving, affectionate metta regarding the other. Even in the midst of anger, or all, we can stop and take a breath and remember the preciousness of this being. And sometimes using a name that's a loving name can be helpful. So Thay uses, Dear One, I am here with you. So this practice of presence, of being in the moment, brought to this being, this path of accompaniment, I am present, I am here, all my practice is unfolding in this moment, with you. What does it really mean to be with someone? It seems so obvious, but you can sit next to someone and not be with them at all. So I actually have spent many years thinking about what is this sacredness of being with, and how do we practice for that? So I am here with you. The second mantra is, Dear One, I see you. And it brings me joy. I see you. I see your beauty. I see your suffering. I see your Buddha nature. I see your radiance. I see your confusion. I see your despair. I see your gifts. I see your challenges. I see you. So it's not just being present, it's the act of seeing the other. The eyes that see deeply. And it brings me joy. This cultivation of joy in the relationship with everything else that's there always, all the sorrow, all the pain, all the despair. Can there be joy? Can we cultivate joy? Can we actually find it? By seeing where it may be, by cultivating it, by really examining what's happening. What is joy? It could be there's joy in with compassion. There's joy in friendship. It's a wonderful and important aspect of relationality, finding the joy. The third mantra, Dear One, I see your suffering, and I am with you. I see your suffering, and I am with you. The first noble truth, internal and external, there is suffering. This sounds very simple, but it's one of the hardest things in life, to be with another, especially if they think you're responsible for it, or if you think you are, or if you think you should be making it better, we turn away. It's very hard to bear. And sometimes the closest relationships are the most difficult to bear. And I am with you in that. I'm not trying to help make it better or solve it or take responsibility. But what does it mean to be with suffering in another as well as oneself? And the last mantra, Dear One, I am suffering. Please be with me. I think a lot of Buddhist practice offers our presence to others, but doesn't teach us a lot about how to be open and willing to share our suffering with others, to let others be with that in a wise way. And the vulnerability, to be able to be comfortable with the vulnerability, with the acceptance of not being in charge or being in control, of life living through us and creating pain. These are all very simple and very difficult to do. And my question for us is, what practices do we have that really support our learning to be with in these ways. And that's a lot of what the book is about, is seeking those practices, a beginning in that. And I think a lot of, since I've been working on this and we've been writing about it, I've been hearing people have been sending me their practices, many couple practices, many practices around being with dying, practices with being with children. There's some beautiful work being done on this. There's a Buddhist community that actually has commitment ceremonies for spiritual friends to make a commitment to each other and to speak that commitment. I personally have a friend who, we didn't start out planning this, but we did start out setting intentional time together on the cushion and then speaking from silence to each other about what was most important in our lives. And that has led to a 30-year every single week practice together. And sometimes she'll call me up and say, I need you to help me remember who I am, really. So it's this kind of really walking together over time and over different life challenges and over aging and continuing that walk with the particulars of the moment, but this very deep commitment to being in life in certain ways and being with each other in life. And so finally, the moments, the relational path, and this being with, I would say, to me, is really about being in the moment together. We talk about being in the moment, here now, and I just add here now together as a really crucial aspect of what's possible in this moment. So I'd like to take some time. Do you have anything? Yeah.
Beautiful. The other last little big piece is through the novel of the Buddha's wife, they go forth together, and they're called to go forth together by illness and war in another community. And so we use that as a way of exploring something that really it's wonderful and a wonder that's arising in our time, which is a whole group of relational activists and relational spiritual activists as another step on this path together.
Let's close with the eight last words, but should we read them last? And then?
Read them and then. No,
yeah. Okay. So the last, we'll end with the last words of the Buddha.
That's not me.
The Buddha's last words are said to be a light unto yourself, seek your own salvation with diligence.
Yashoda's last words might have been, sometimes you need the light of others to see the way. Sometimes you need to be a light for others. And always the light will shine more brightly when two or more are gathered in spirit.
And what about the shared path? We might say every doorway opens to the path. There is no right door or right way.
Sometimes in the dark night, we need to find our own way or to lead the way alone. Sometimes we need to rely on others. Always we can share our light and find a new brightness in community, which will reveal to us what we are only beginning to see alone. And I think that hope of seeing together is really the ultimate hope for all of us in this world. So, before we close, we have a few moments for reflection or question or what touched you or what confused you or just how you might have received this. Thank you. Thank you.
I have a teacher's voice. Can everyone hear me?
Oh, you're recording. Okay. I'd like to go over two words that what you said remind me. In the Jewish Bible, the Jewish God calls out to Abraham and he answers, I'm here. And the Hebrew word is hineni. And what's powerful is that there are no punctuation marks between the calling forth and the response. And how many in our lives can we depend on for that? When someone calls out to us, do they say, I'm here? Not, who wants to know what's in it for me? I'm grateful I have one friend I can do that with. Mm-hmm. And the other word is shamati. With the Jewish mantra, the first word is shema. It means to listen or hear. And for those people who are more traditional, we hear someone talk, and they're finished, and we say, shamati. It means, I hear you. I listened.
I'm part of a sangha in Phoenix, Arizona.
And in what?
In Phoenix, Arizona.
Ah.
And we meet on a regular basis. And one of our teachers, his ex-wife died, and very, very violently. It was terrible that he was left being a single parent of four daughters. And last weekend, we had a very intentional meeting to sit and talk about how we could support him, not just as a sangha, but as a group, as individuals, in his growth, in his practice, as well as supporting his children, because now they are without a mother. And so when you were talking about this relational piece, I thought, that's what it reminded me of. It's like being able to say, we're here, we're being very intentional about building these relationships. And I always say I'm a grandma wannabe. I may never be an actual grandma, but I offered to be the grandma, you know, to sit there and take them out and do things.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think the relationships are so important. And the Sangha is a big part of that. It's like, how do we form a relationship with each other? So I appreciate it.
And how? For me, the questions are, what's possible?
Mm-hmm.
We touch sometimes what's possible. And in the same way, we touch, mindfulness is with us all the time. What's possible in its fruition? What's possible in relationship that we haven't even yet touched? And I think of you're talking about the friend that you can do that with. What if we lived in a world where that was really the norm? It's an extraordinary shift in another dimension to even imagine into. Yeah.
Thank you for your book, Together. My question is that I'm curious how you put this book together, because I heard him referring to the book as a novel, mm-hmm. but of course it's not just a novel, as we see. My question is, what part of it is historical, you know, in terms of Buddha, the Buddha historical perspective? And some of the words probably had been described in the Pali canon that could have been extracted into constructing the skeleton of that. And how do you then merge your practice and your perspective into this skeleton of, you know, historical perspective? It's very, must be challenging for me to see how that put together. I'd like to hear something about it.
I think but what's interesting is those five mentions that I talked about earlier and how it inspired a picture of life, of a whole path. Partly, I think, it was just having listened to so many lives, and there was something very intuitive about the way the story kind of wrote itself. It was kind of amazing. It really felt like as we channeled it or as we really tried to imagine into it together, it began to actually write itself, which Steve is a fiction writer, and I'm just learning that. So it's so different than writing nonfiction in terms of that sense of it writing itself. And the interesting thing is I met a woman recently, Wendy Garling, who's publishing a book this summer called Stars at Dawn. She's a Sanskrit scholar who found untranslated stories of the early women in the Buddha's life, and it's being published by Shambhala this summer. And she said there was a lot of things that she uncovered that she felt we had intuited in the book. And we were very clear that we were making this up, and it was a lens of modern lens, not an old lens. And yet, at the same time, I read as much as I could about women under early Buddhism and all of the texts of the nuns, different translations, and the way it has come down through many different sources. Go ahead.
Well, it's a very good question. I think I've come to realize that, you know, I've been a writer for many, many years, and I've come to realize that with a novel, which this first half is, I mean, as I hear you read and as I read, it's like we didn't do this.
Yeah.
You know, who did this in a way? You know. It's like, well, how can we find them? Can we find them again? You know, but it is you immerse yourself in everything that you know, and you immerse yourself. And luckily, there are only five facts, which was wonderful because we had
facts.
Well, five mentions in the early sutras. So we had, but it was beginning, middle, and end. It was terrific. So we, you know, we had that structure. But I really do think from all these years of writing, and Janet and I, this is the third thing we've written together. We wrote a play called Bill W. and Dr. Bob together as well. It's not me. It's not us. We sat there, and this just came through. It's like a practice now that I'm getting older I indulge in a lot, which is I'm not this body. I'm not just this body. You know, and that's what the process is. It's a spiritual process. I really think that. The typing isn't necessarily spiritual. But
I think I feel very connected to the Buddha's wife. I feel very glad to have told her story. I feel a lot of love for her and the representation of the hidden path. There was a great goodness that came in that. For me, it was just an interesting way to show up together to do it. And it wasn't planned exactly, it came that way. But the sort of backwards, the sense of going back now to her life and taking moments along that path and then drawing them out in terms of ripe moments in lives that are ripe for awakening and for relational practice. And I think there were many, many practice moments for me that led me to be able to strongly name this and believe in it and have faith that this was an aspect of the path from my practice, my single practice, my Sangha practice, my beloved community of CDL practice at Spirit Rock, from the 12-step fellowship, the experience of a community of awakening, from Joanna Macy's work, Coming to Life, And from moments along the way, my first meditation teacher, Vimala Thakkar, who was an Indian woman who used to say very authoritative, "We must learn to live together."
She also said she was our first teacher and a marvelous sort of Hinduism and Buddhism and Krishnamurti, a social activist as well. And she says, the purpose of life is to live. There is no other purpose than to live. And to live is to be related. Yeah. I think that had a strong effect. I also want to say that we did this with the utmost appreciation and respect for the Buddhist path. You know, that was part of the story. But this is about something a little different and how they coalesce.
The shared path is really the dedication to the moments and the ways our practice, the alone part is essential and the together part is essential. And the flow of those and the interpenetration of those as our meditation practice, which is my practice right now, is how do these co-arise, co-influence, and that I think we need to end with. But I just take a moment to end in some silence and to also remember the relationship that came to your heart and just offer the dedication to the investigation, to the unfolding, the wisdom and compassion in meeting this. May the work of our practice, our lives, be a benefit to all beings, all relations, those born and to be born. May all beings find joy and happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the roots of suffering. May all beings find the way to peace. Peace within us. Peace between us. Peace all around us. May there be peace.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.